Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 3, delivered on August 30, 2016. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Today, the Federal Reserve. This is the first of two special topics back to back. Today is the Federal Reserve, and Thursday is Ethics and Agency. You all have had an economics course. I am assuming that you were at least somewhat exposed to this, but maybe not. You weren't told how important what I'm going to tell you is. So I'm going to go back over it in a little more depth and detail, talk about it from a financial perspective, and include some important broader financial concepts along the way. The first thing that I'll do here is bring up a more technical understanding of what it means to be a borrower or a lender. Ma'am, could I borrow $100 from you?
Sure.
Okay. Actually, what I'll do, I'm going to borrow this for a year. So what I'll probably do is borrow somewhat less than $100, and then I'll give her back $100. And that difference will be the interest that you earn on the account. Technically speaking, what I am doing is selling her a debt instrument. Let's say for $98. And she is buying it for $98. She's the buyer. I am the seller. The two terms for the borrower you'll hear me use from time to time. The borrower is the seller of the debt security. Or sometimes a fancier term is I am the issuer of the debt security. Now, she might actually write up the agreement, but it is technically mine to sell to her. Like if you go to a bank to borrow money for a home loan, they'll have the paperwork right there in front of you. You just sign it. However, you are the issuer. They'll give it to you first, you sign it, and then you give it back to them. So you are issuing it to them. They are buying it for the loan amount. The lender is the purchaser or the buyer. You can say it either way. It's kind of important for you to understand that. Now, once you get that down, and it takes a while to get used to that terminology, but Now I'm going to take you on a fantasy journey into the United States government. Our government borrows money. It's a great way to start this. The government borrows money. It borrows short-term money, which we call bill. Any kind of loan that is a year or less is called a bill. From one to, I don't know, sometimes I'll see this, 1 to 7 years, that's called a note. And over 7 years is called a bond. So if you finally are going to achieve your dream, you're going to buy a mobile home, one of the 45-foot wide ones, double wide, because you gained a little weight and all that. So when you come to me, the banker, what you are going to do is we negotiate this. And if I say yes, you're going to issue me, this is going to be a 20-year loan, you're going to issue me a bond. I will buy the bond. I am underwriting your debt security. I might sell it off right away to some large secondary mortgage market. But you issued a bond, okay? So, now car loan, those are usually about 4 to 6 years. So what would be the terminology for that?
A note.
Yes, it's a note. So you are the issuer of a note. A bank that lends you the money is the buyer of the note for the price of the car or whatever you need to borrow if you've got a down payment. Private corporations and the governments of the world borrow money. And if they're fairly sophisticated, they'll borrow money on a combination of debt securities. Some will be short term, very short term, quick working capital for corporations, quick money to pay some quick bills for the government. Then they'll also issue some notes and some bonds. Now, these animals right here are generally going to be structured differently. When you borrow money long term, you're going to borrow on a car loan and you'll make payments. Those payments will pay the interest and part of the debt. You will amortize the debt. That's how private consumer loans work. That's not how corporate and government debt works. Corporate and government debt, all the borrower does through the life of the loan is pay the interest. They service the debt. Only at the end do they make one last interest payment and pay off the face that they borrowed, the face amount they borrow. It's just the way it's done. So if a corporation buys, let's say we've got a corporation with a trading symbol, BNR. Let's say it's 6% Sometimes I'll put 2000. All that's telling me is that they're borrowing money for 20 years, from 30 years, and they are going to pay 6% on that. Well, what do I know else? There's something very important here. The face value, what they owe, is always in increments of $1,000. Always. I don't have to say that. It just is. So if a corporation borrows $100,000, it issues 100 BNR 6% 46s or something like that. So this 6% is calculated, always stated on the face. So in other words, the corporation is going to send an interest check for $60 every year for 30 years. At the end of 30 years, in 2046, they'll send one last $60 check, and they'll also send the $1,000. That's how government and corporate debt works. That's just how it's done. They don't amortize the debt along the way. Although there are usually some agreements within the bond covenants that say, well, you've got to start putting money aside so that you have the money at the end to pay. It's not part of what you as a lender to a corporation would do. A couple other. Up here, these are kind of odd animals. Very large credit-worthy corporations borrow money real short-term for working capital, to pay bills before cash comes in. The term in the private market for very short-term debt, like 30-day debt, this is called commercial paper. Very large credit-worthy corporations are doing this all the time. It's a huge, huge market. It's a huge market. And it's always at really good interest rates, although, interestingly enough, there have been a couple of shockwaves over the past many years. There was a corporation. Now, remember, large creditworthy corporations issue commercial paper, and it's picked up by lenders all the time. There was a, back in the day, there was this scam, this corporation that went totally corrupt. It was called Enron. In their last few months, they were covering their tracks, making it look like nothing was going wrong. And the executives were siphoning off money into offshore accounts. So it was like only a couple, I think it was only a couple of weeks before the company completely imploded. These cats issued a pile of commercial paper. And of course, the capital markets picked it up. Oh, yeah, or the money markets picked it up. Oh, sure, we'll lend it. It's Enron. You're a great corporation. And they got screwed on that deal. Because Enron collapsed, the executives were last seen leaving town in a late model Learjet to go to their offshore accounts, and the lenders were kind of burnt. So the interest rates kind of bumped up for a while. There was a trust issue. Sort of the lender said, commercial paper isn't as safe as we had always thought it was. But the market has calmed down again. That was long ago. Commercial paper is a very common thing out there in the market these days. Okay, so now, that's private. Companies borrow money all the time on a short-term basis. Bill kind of money. Even my company does. One of the things you'll see small companies, even big companies do, is at the right before a season begins, we'll borrow money, okay, during the dark, bad times, before you got cash flow. We set up a line of credit, we borrow money, to build inventory, to pay our employees, to pay the light bills and all that. And then as we start to sell stuff in the good season, we then paid off the money we've borrowed. That's called working capital. And most banks will set things up. So for example, furniture dealers, boat dealers, car dealers, they'll borrow big money, they'll borrow money, and they'll just keep borrowing until it comes time for them to be able to start making money off their inventory, and then they pay down their bills, pay down this bill as it is. The government's a little bit odd. I told you that one, the government borrow $1,000. It needs money. Short term. These are called, this is government. We generally call these T-bills, treasury bills. The treasury is borrowing money. So what happens is lenders lend the government somewhat less than $1,000. And in exactly 1 year, the government pays them $1,000 back. So the lenders make their money off the differential. Back in the day, now it's all done electronically. It's like the speed of light, blink of an eye, and all that. Back in the day, though, before all the computers and stuff like that, there was literally an auction for treasuries. The government would want to borrow a bunch of money. It might throw out onto the table a bunch of T-bills, some notes, some bonds. It would have a combination in most auctions. Some auctions were tighter. So let me take you on a journey with an auction that is only exactly 1 year T-bills. Just 1 year T-bills. Now let's try to think. We're going to have someone be, that was different. Where the hell was, okay. Ma'am, you are a treasury bill buyer. And I am the hostess of the treasury bill auction. My name is Mabel. And you come in, and you're going to buy your very first T-bill.
And so I come up, well, hello there. You're a new person here at the auction. Well, would you like to, you're going to buy a T-bill, aren't you? Well, let me show you some pretty ones over here. Something that will go with the decor in your house, perhaps, early American Gothic and all that. Or here, we got one right here. It's really a pretty T-bill, really a nice T-bill. Now, you get $1,000 back in 1 year if you buy it today. Okay. A lot of people are looking at these T-bills, kicking the T-bill tires and all that. So remember, others are going to be bidding for these too. But I'm going to be nice to you. Offer me a decent price for this T-bill, and I will sell it to you for that price, okay? So remember, you get $1,000 back in 1 year, so what do you want to pay me for it right now? Oh, are you out of your mind? No, this is government. Say $9.75. $9.75. Earl! One T-bill, $9.75. Put it in a bag. Drag it through the garden. Do you want cheese on it? Yes, you do. Okay. So, the price, the face value, the dollar interest earned, and the, now this isn't tough math, just make sure you do it right. Okay, now, what was the price that you paid for it? $975. Okay. Every T-bill, every debt instrument, commercial or government, has a specific face value. What is it? No, don't be afraid. Just say it. $1,000. For the rest of your life, someday, 40 years from now, you're going to be walking down a street in Chicago, and this very old man is going to come up to you. Yeah, woman. What's the face value of any debt, corporate or government debt instrument? It turns out that it's me. I'm homeless. I'm on the streets of Chicago. I'm wearing a nightgown. Obviously, I made it out of a hospital. I got a little problem with this tube leaking, dripping down my leg. Shut up. So we're. Work with me, and you'll say $1,000, and I'll go away happy, okay? And then you'll quickly call the police and all that. Okay, so it's $1,000. Okay, so how much interest in dollars did you earn in a year? How much interest in dollars did you earn in a year? $25. I'm making this a lot harder than it is. It's $25. Okay, so now we can find out the yield on this, what yield she earned on this. It would be $25 over, and here's the part, don't get this wrong. It's over $9.75. She invested $9.75, not $1,000. $9.75. On the quiz, I will try to trick you by giving you the answer if you put $1,000 in there. I'll do that. I'm a jerk, okay? Remember, it's what you invested. She invested $9.75 and she pulled $25. So at the end of the day, I should have had this on instead of this calculator. Seriously, where's my calculator? There it is. So I'm going to take 25 divided by 9.75, and I get a 2.56% interest rate. You got it? Okay. Now you calculated your first bond, in this case, debt yield. That's your first debt yield. Well, a year later goes by, and you show back up again at one of these T-bill auctions. Well, there you are again. You came out good on the last one, and I'm sure you just got your $1,000 check, so you're back here to buy again. Oh, I'm so happy for you coming back like this. I told my son about you. He's a little bit strange. He eats Cheetos in the basement, and he doesn't work. But he's a nice boy. So now, what are you going to pay for these pretty tea bills? Now, you look around, and there aren't many people here this time. It's a lot quieter. The demand is not as strong. So if the demand is not so strong, what are you going to offer for me for a price this time? There's still people there, but not as many. Oh, that's awfully cruel of you, you capitalist running dog. Let's say $9.50, okay? Yeah. $9.50. Earl! $9.50 on a T-bill! $9.50. A good lady? What is the face value?
1,000.
Bingo. 1,000. You don't want that creepy old man coming up to you in Chicago, do you? Yeah. 1,000. So, in this case, how much dollar interest did she earn this time? $50. $50. So now, the yield will be $50 over, I love it when you talk like that, $9.50. That 1,000 has nothing to do with this. Get that out of your mind. Okay, so now if I honk this one out, I get 5.26. I thought it was a... You have now seen an example of one of the most fundamental principles in finance. You're probably not noticing. Well, maybe you are. Maybe you are. What happens, sir, when the price goes down? What happens to the yield? That's exactly right. The price goes up. The yield goes up. Price goes down, yield goes up. Price goes up, yield goes down. They are perfectly and mathematically inversely related. It is a mathematical thing. It's not even finance. It's just a mathematical principle that when bond prices fall, that means bond yields are going up. So that if you are one of those news hounds who is interested in seeing what's going on in the bond market, well, bond prices fell today. That means that the yields on bonds are rising today. Fundamental principle. And this is true, not even of bonds, it's true in general of all securities. Prices sliding is the same thing as saying that either an explicit or an implicit yield is rising. So if markets think that interest rates are going to start rising in the near future, the Fed's going to tighten the money supply, you will probably see a reaction of prices of stocks and bonds going down. They'll slide because of that inverse relationship. It's not going to be perfect in any way, shape, or form because risk factors are involved. But the underlying motion, pressure of rising interest rates will be falling stock prices. One of the reasons we've had this hugely booming stock market for the last few years was because the Federal Reserve was keeping interest rates stupidly low. Dropping interest rates like that, well, of course you're going to have rising stock prices because it is just a more attractive. So there's that. One of the most important concepts in finance. Now, I'll take you on a journey. The Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, well, give you a little history of it, but I'm going to put up a little video made by the Federal Reserve that also explains this too. So some of what I'm going to tell you here, I'm going to post the link to it. Look on my
podcasting website. That'll be where the link shows up first. I'll also post it in ReggieNet and on Pearson, link to the... It's a cheesy animated video, but it does explain kind of pretty well the basics of the Federal Reserve. I want to take you a little beyond the basics, but here's the deal. After the Civil War, there were so many scams in banking going around. Well, heck, before the Civil War, it was just kind of like a free-for-all, which was one of the... I'll get into that later, but anyway, after the Civil War, banks were falling apart right and left, setting up, going down. There were these things called sod banks that were set up on a whim out on the prairie here, and then they would issue their own money, and then it would collapse. And then there was, in New York City, there was a big problem with banks. A lot of banks were undercapitalized. Essentially, you take in depositors' money, and you're supposed to lend some of that out so you can make some money as a bank. Some banks were lending out way too much of their deposits, so when the depositors came back to get their money, they didn't have it, and the bank just collapsed right there. And then other banks that were more prudent fell down in the mess, because when you see one bank freak out, die, everyone freaks out and goes to their banks. So these banks that had decent reserves got overrun too in these bank panics. In fact, interestingly enough, there were some real nasty rich players in the market that would start rumors about banks just for the purpose of having those banks get a run on them. You know, you're a prudent banker. You're keeping 20% of your depositors' money in reserve. But if everyone thinks you don't have any money, they all come in and you don't have the money to pay them and you're dead. And then these big, powerful bankers and rich money families would step in and take over these banks that were dead and essentially build their little oligopoly outward. These bank problems, the scammers, the players, and all that, got to be such a problem that they were causing more than just microeconomic suffering. And that was pretty serious. You'd have people lose their entire life savings just in a day when a bank collapsed. It got to be a political problem. And it also got to be almost like a macroeconomic problem. You had these, when you have a bunch of banks in the center of banking fall apart, well, that can have ripples outside of New York City. So in the second decade of the 20th century, the United States government passed a bill called the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act created a central bank of the United States. It created a central bank of the United States. And with the hope that with a central bank, there'd be an iron fist that could get the banking system under control. It was great in theory, but by the 1920s, the playas were really having their game again. We had the best government money could buy, and unfortunately, the whole thing came crashing down. It was only in the 30s, during the reform period, that the Fed got really tough again. But anyway, the Federal Reserve Act gave the central bank three specific authorities. One, it would regulate and supervise the banking system. It would regulate and supervise the banking system. Now, here's how the structure of the Fed is. The Federal Reserve is actually broken down into 12 districts. There are 12 districts, and each district has its own bank. District bank. Now, interestingly, the districts out west were huge because there weren't as many people out there. It's kind of changed now, but they never changed the structure of the district banks. Now, each one has a district bank. Do I have a dollar on me? No, I don't. But if you look on dollar bills, you'll see that they have a letter on them, and that letter represents which of the district banks did the printing of that money. Now, the 12 district banks are overseen by a central board of governors. There are seven of them. One of the seven is the chairman. Watch out for me to try to catch you. There are seven governors plus a chairman. No, the chairman is one of the seven. The chairman right now is Janet Yellen, Y-E-L-L-E-N. Strange thing I saw in the paper just a couple of days ago, and I try to stay on top of this, but they said, they used a term for another one of the governors. They said co-chairman. And I don't think I had ever seen that term before. There always was a chairman, and then the other six governors. So whatever this is, you know, it's kind of a new thing. I don't know. But the Board of Governors regulates. The district banks supervise. So the governors make the rules. And the district banks enforce the rules. Each bank in its district. Now, right here where we are actually very close to a boundary between two districts, St. Louis to the south, Chicago to the north. We're in Chicago. I probably will take students up to the Federal Reserve this in October or maybe in the spring. And if I'm going to go to one, the different district banks have different flavors, different things that they're specialized in. Now, my experience, St. Louis, for example, is considered the education Fed. If you want a job, they have a lot of research they do, but they also do a lot of educational outreach, producing educational publications, even games and things like that, online games. And they have speakers go out from the St. Louis Fed. The Chicago Fed is much stiffer, more uptight. Give you an example. I took students a couple of years ago down to the St. Louis Fed. They just, were you along for that trip? Okay, it was actually, I don't know if any of you were, they just rolled out the red carpet for us. They had the chief economist talk to us, these recruiters for the different divisions, their analytics division, their education division, speak to all of my students. It was just a really great experience. Of course, there was security was like, you wouldn't believe around there. And it's not even a joke. They got some seriously good weaponry down. They can call up and shoot your butt. But it was a really great experience. Of course, they were almost throwing job offers. We'd love to have you for an intern. We'd love to give you a job. We'll pay for your master's degree and your PhD and all this. And of course, everyone said, but that's St. Louis. I hate St. Louis. I want to go back to Chicago. Yeah, so you can get robbed on the Miracle Mile. Anyway, it was a great experience. Contrast that with the time I took them to the Chicago Fed. They packed us into this tiny room where they had this security supervisor. She was just built like a brick. And she's just standing there with her nightstick like this, staring at us, walking single file, keeping an eye on us so that we could go into this room where they showed us money and all that. And I mean, I'm at the back of the line, and I'm following my students in, and she stops me and hits me with her nightstick right on the knuckles. I said, ow, damn, that hurt. She hit me hard. I mean, it turned out she was really great. We went out on a date. It was really, anyway, no. But it was really not fun. It was not a good experience. You could tell this Chicago Fed was much less interested in the people aspect of banking. They were, we're really too important for this kind of nonsense with you bringing your little students in here. And that was such a huge contrast with the St. Louis Fed, where they were just lavish for us, and they really did a nice job. And I just wish some of the students had taken them up on their offer. But anyway, another thing that the Fed does is serve as a bank for banks. Banks need a place to put their money. They can't put it in their own bank. So, in other words, the Federal Reserve offers commercial services to banks in the country. They go in direct competition with private commercial banks that also offer commercial banking services for banks. The rule with the Fed is that any time they are tasked to keep improving the technology of banking, and if they do come up with new technology, they are required to share it with all of their private competitor banks. So, let me take you to the upshot of this. I thought, back in my early days, I thought, well, how could any commercial bank survive? I mean, you got this 800-pound gorilla of the Fed offering commercial services to banks. Why would any private bank do commercial services for banks? Turns out, I was wrong. I have some good contacts at the Fed in St. Louis. I called and I said, "All right, in your district, in the St. Louis district, how many what's the percentage of banks that use the Fed versus what's the percentage of banks that use private commercial banks for their banking?" And he told me at the time it was about 65% of the banks used the Federal Reserve, and 35% of banks in the area used private commercial banks for their banking services. So in this case, this public competitor functions right alongside of commercial banks. And so I looked at the commercial banks that do banking services. They make good profit. They're doing fine. I actually, at the time when the whole Affordable Health Care Act was being debated in Congress, I said, wouldn't this be this model could work for the healthcare system too. You could have, instead of having a one-payer system, you could do like the Fed does, just set up a payer and have it compete against private competitors. With the understanding that the public competitor, one, couldn't do predatory pricing, but it could do competitive pricing. And whenever it had technological improvements, which it is supposed to spend most of its money on, it has to share them with the private, its private competitors. No one wanted to hear anything about that, even though this Bank for Banks is one of the most successful operations the Fed has been doing, and it's been doing it for decades. Interesting little story there most people don't know about. Okay, the last one is that the Fed conducts monetary policy. This is the one you probably know the most about. The Fed controls the money supply. Originally, and for decades, until the 1970s, the Fed had one and only one goal for monetary policy. The Fed's job was to maintain stability of the aggregate price level. That's a fancy way of saying the Fed's job was to make sure there was no inflation or deflation. Neither of those was to occur. That was what the Fed's job was, is to keep the money supply growing at exactly the real growth rate of the economy. In other words, provide sufficient liquidity as the economy grows. But if you put too much in, you get inflation. Put too little in, and you get deflation. The Fed's job is to make sure that none of that happens at all. Unfortunately, in the 1970s, Congress passed an act that charged the Federal Reserve with another job for monetary policy. The act just essentially said the Fed is in charge of using the money supply to improve the economy, to help the economy. Print more money when there are bad times, claw it back in when there are bad times, which of course is essentially at odds with controlling inflations and deflations. The Fed has ever since, pretty much, it helps the economy until inflation begins to scare it, and then it backs down and tries to claw back the money supply. Anyway, now the Fed has three tools of monetary policy. The first one is a blunt instrument. You wouldn't see the Fed do it hardly ever. It is the Fed sets the required reserve ratio. Here's how that works. It's been known. I mean, I've seen reference to this even back in ancient Greek literature, and in the Romans knew the concept. Medieval bankers grasped it as well. It works like this. Suppose you had a giant pile of money fall from the sky. It landed right in front of you, $1,000. Now, are you going to pick that money up, or are you just going to walk away from it? Sure, you're going to pick it up. So let's say that you run to me. I'm a banker, and you put that money in the bank. Now, the Federal Reserve, and before the Federal Reserve, banks did this on their own. All through history, they've known, okay, we keep some of the money in the vault so that the depositor can come back and get it if the depositor needs it. So let's say that the reserve ratio is 20%. So that would mean that the bank has $200 that it's going to have to keep in the vault in case you come back in and ask for some of your money. Or you write a check and we have to honor it. But then that means that the bank has $800 to lend. Now you, sir, I'm the banker, and you come to me and you have a great idea for a business. What kind of business? No, you don't look like the Breaking Bad sort. Besides, I wouldn't lend that money to you. Okay, let's try this. You want to start your own internet Lonely Hearts Club. Well, obviously for that you're going to need a small building. You're going to need some computers, good internet connections. And I say, well, how much do you need? And you say, well, I need $800. Well, I'll say, well, I'll be darned. I've got $800 to lend. Okay, so I lend you the $800. You pay the internet genius here to take care of all the work. You pay him the $800. He comes back to my bank, and he deposits $800. You see what's happening? See how the balance sheet is growing? No more money, but the balance sheet. So $800, 20% of that is $160. So that leaves $640. To lend. And you come into my bank and you say, well, I need some money. What for? Well, I want to start a dried flower arrangements business. Okay, well, that's great. Fine. How much do you need? I'm figuring about $640. So I say, great, I've got $640. I'll lend it to you. You hire this genius in flower arrangements. You pay her $640. She comes to my bank and she deposits $640, of which I keep in reserve $128, and that leaves for me, oh God, now I have to do some real arithmetic, $522, is that right? Oh, someone help me, I forgot. No, 500 and...
532?
For God's sake. Well, what is it? 512 here. 128 there. 20% is 64 times 2 is 128. Okay, good. Do you see what's happening? The money supply is growing every time. If you want to see what the final result of one infusion of $1,000 is, all you have to do is take the money multiplier is 1 over the required reserve ratio. So what you would do in this case is you'd say, okay, that would be 1 over 0.20, which is 5. So you take 5 times the original deposit, the original amount, and you've got $5,000. At the end of the day, this stream of deposits will create $5,000 out of a $1,000 initial deposit. Without even printing money, it happens. Now, the interesting part about this, notice what happens. If you lower the required reserve ratio, the money multiplier goes up. If the required reserve ratio was only 10%, that initial $1,000 deposit would have created $10,000. Interesting thing. But notice, remember what I said. This is a blunt instrument. I mean, it could cause the money supply to go boom by jerking it a few hundred basis points. Now, it's been 6, 7, 8 years ago, someone said, well, what is the required reserve ratio? Right now. And I thought, you know, in bad times when people are afraid that banks aren't going to come through, the Fed will nudge the required reserve ratio up just to make sure the banks have plenty of money. And if people are real confident about the economy and the banking system, they'll nudge it down. But honestly, I didn't know what it was, so I called St. Louis Fed. I said, all right, what's the required reserve ratio? And the fellow I talked to at that time, he said, well, it's not as simple as it is in the economics textbooks. And I thought, well, he just cut me down a few notches because I thought there was a required reserve ratio. He said, no, there's not. He said, there are actually 3 required reserve ratios. The first, I think, I should look this up before I tell you, but I'm not going to hold you to the numbers. I think he said the first $10 million tranche of money, T-R-A-N-C-H-E, the first $10 million tranche of money, the required reserve ratio is 0. I said, what? He said, yeah. And the tranche from $10 million to $50 million, it was some number like 2.5%. And above $50 million, it was like 6%. So it depends on how big the bank is. Because every bank can lend out every penny of its first $10 million. And then it can lend out all but about like 97% of its next $40 million. And then money above that, it has to keep a little more of it. So it wasn't as simple as what I had always thought it was. I learned kind of a lesson there. But if you think about it, that's kind of weird. Small banks, if I understand what they're saying, small banks aren't required, at least by required reserve ratio standards, to keep money in their vault. They can lend it all. I am sure they do. They're not nuts, but apparently that's not how it works. Okay, that's the required reserve ratio, big blunt instrument. Then the next tool of monetary policy is called the discount rate. This is where the story gets a little more infuriating. See, a bank, yeah.
Sorry, but what does MM and MO stand?
That MM is the money multiplier.
And
the M0 is the original amount put in.
Oh,
yeah. Okay, the discount rate. It's kind of dry, but here's where it gets a little bit less dry in the backstory. You see, a bank might need to borrow money. It can borrow money from the Fed at a rate that is set by the Fed. Or it can borrow money from other banks in the interbank lending market. Now, the Fed lends at the discount window at this discount rate. That's the Federal Reserve. The private market will lend at what is called the federal funds rate. This is not set by the Federal Reserve. It is set by the supply and demand forces of the market itself. How much money is in the federal funds market? How much money have banks deposited? How much demand is there for that money? It's a free market rate. The Fed targets the federal funds rate. It says we want it to be here, and they'll do what they can to change the supply and demand for money. But they can't set it directly. You might catch it. I've heard it so many times on these financial news programs. The Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate at. No, they didn't. They can set a target for it, but they can't set the federal funds rate. They can move it. They can try to manipulate it by pushing money into the system, pulling money out from the banking system, but they can't set it. They can set the discount rate. Now, the discount rate is below the federal funds rate. The federal funds rate is an open market rate, and it's going to be above what the Fed offers. Historically, most banks, even though it was a higher rate, they would go to the federal funds market and borrow from other banks instead of borrowing cheaper from the Fed. Why would they do that? Why would banks deliberately, wantonly, yeah. It's actually kind of like that. It's kind of like that. Think about it this way. Think about it this way. Okay. You, sir, right there, you look like someone who's really nice on the surface, but deep down, you do some very questionable things. And you've gotten yourself into a situation where you need $1,000 ASAP. Now, you got your friend there who's got plenty of money, and you've got me, your dad. Now, I will lend the money. You know I lend money to you, and I don't even charge you interest. Your friend, he's not stupid. He's going to charge you interest, hard interest. So you walk in and you look at, here's Dad.
Where the hell have you been? And why is that funny look on your face? Did I hear gunshots outside?
You can ask me for the money.
I've got a really thick belt.
Or you can ask your bud. Yeah, it's bro time. Yeah, okay. You see, it goes back to the point you were making. The Fed, you don't just go up to the Fed, hi guys, I need some money. Why? I kind of like spent the other money. You should hear some of the stories I hear from the regulators. One of their problems down here when they watch the bank, when they're going in and doing audits of the banks, these little banks down here, they catch so many times these banks have been suckered into these high-risk lending to these Chicago types for some grand new project or some condo complex, and the boys in Chicago schmooze the executives of the bank, and they take them to dinner, they show them all these blueprints and plans. Oh yeah, I'll lend you guys all that money. No, are you out of your mind? Don't do that. So you see, banks can sometimes be less than prudent, and so they might ask their buddies for the money. But we came through a horrendous crisis in 2008. And I'll say this and I'll mention it a few more times. On September 15th of 2008, we were within a couple of hours of the entire financial system of the world falling into total apocalypse. It's as simple as that. About 2 hours, we were that close to absolute something that you would not be here. Some of you wouldn't even be alive now. No, your gaming skills playing GTA and all that Call of Duty would not prepare you for that world. We were 2 hours maybe away on September 15th, 2008. So everybody covered up the disaster as fast and as hard as they could. And in the process, they started shoveling money. They wanted banks to have liquidity. They just poured it in. A lot of that money was in a secret program. The cover was blown on it in 2010. At that point, there was about $7.7 trillion already poured into the banks. I was, like many other financial analysts, we were recommending shorting the banks, shorting as hard as you could the banks, preparing for bad things because the banks were on paper, they were nearly dead. It turned out that they weren't because of the secret program that was going on, shoveling money in. But anyway, the Fed pushed the discount rate down to the point where banks couldn't refuse it, you know, like 0.1%. 0%. They figured, and of course the banks just lined up for this money. Free money. Yeah, sure, we'll take that money. And the thinking, well, okay, the banks will have all this liquidity. They'll lend money to people. They'll lend money to businesses. And the economy can come out of this absolutely near disaster fairly quickly. Well, the banks had other plans. They didn't lend that money out. They put it into their own speculative investments overseas in the United States. They kept saying, well, there's a credit crisis. We can't be lending money to people and businesses. They might default on us. And it was just to the point where even the pro-business Fed and it was just going bananas. Will you lend this money? Oh, we can't lend it out. We got a credit crisis going on. So they were borrowing all this money at the discount window at insanely low rates, and they were making money hand over fist on it, investing it in things other than the American economy. This went on for about 3 years, and it was just like, I mean, that was the principal reason, according to major business publications like Business Week and Forbes. That was the principal reason that the recession was so protracted, was that the banks would not unlock that money that they were borrowing. Okay, so there you are. The discount rate is sort of like a signal the Fed uses. If the Fed, in one of its meetings, bumps up the discount rate, that signals that the Fed's intention is to start clamping down on the money supply. If the Fed drops the interest rate, that's the signal the Fed sees the economy as weak and in need of help. If the Fed holds the discount rate solid, the Fed is more or less signaling that the economy is on track, but it is too fragile for a movement one way or the other, especially upward. Last one, it's a killer. The open market operations, OMOs. Now, the first one setting the required reserve ratio, rarely used. The discount rate being used, not too frequently. They can move it at any meeting they want, or even have a special meeting to move it. They generally don't move it unless there's a good reason. But these open market operations, those are happening every day, day in, day out, to the tune of billions of dollars flowing in this market that no one outside of business and economics academics and profession know anything about. This is the mover of short-term interest rates. It works like this. Here's a bank. Here's the domestic trading desk at the Fed. Now, the DTD is in the New York City Bank, the Empire Bank. Now, in Tier 1, in other words, really liquid, safe capital, the bank will have money, and it will have T-bills. It'll have T-bills. These are both highly liquid, incredibly safe. A bank is supposed to keep some of this money, this very safe capital. It can use other capital for risky things, but it has this. Now, every trader, the traders at the domestic trading desk of the Federal Reserve, they have a portfolio of dollars that the Fed has printed for them, and they have T-bills that the Fed has bought for them at auctions and from banks. You, sir, you're a domestic trading desk trader. I'm a banker. The Board of Governors has just decided add liquidity to the economy. In other words, push dollars into the economy. Now, you as a trader, the manager of the desk has put you to the task. Get money into the banks. Get money into the banks. Well, you have dollars and you have T-bills. I'm a banker. I have dollars and T-bills. Those are the only two things we can trade. So you're going to offer to buy some of my T-bills, because if I buy them, if I sell them to you, well, that's going to help out, okay, right? Okay, so you call me up on the phone and you offer me, you want to buy my T-bill. Ring, ring, and you offer me, you're going to tell me you want to buy one of my T-bills. Now, you start with a price of $950 for that T-bill. Hello? Oh, it's you. You what? You want to buy T-bills, okay? How much are you going to buy my T-bills for? Go to hell. Click. So you call me back. Ring, ring. Yeah. Offer me again. $975, go to hell. Click. Call me back. Oh, don't do $1,000, for God's sake. Something under. There's got to be some interest on it. Okay. What happened? What was he doing? He was bidding up the price of a T-bill on me. What happens when the price of a T-bill goes up? What happens to its yield? Well, spank me, Jesus. He is actually driving down interest rates on T-bills, doing what he's doing, isn't he? Do you see it? By the process, and you're not the only one. You've got a whole ocean of traders doing this with banks. So what's going to happen is I send you a T-bill, and you send me some dollars that go into the federal funds market. That goes into that giant pool of money out there where all the bank's money is. Dollars, dollars, dollars. And now you've got more dollars in there. So you've got the price for federal funds, the federal funds rate. Okay. You got the supply of funds, okay, the quantity of lendable funds. So you got the demand for lendable funds, you got the supply of lendable funds, you've added money, slides the supply curve outward, whoops, yeah, that's really good, slides the supply curve outward, so the federal funds rate goes from here down to here. So the Fed has, through the back door, manipulated the federal funds rate downward. Directly, it caused T-bill prices, T-bill yields to fall. Indirectly, it caused the federal funds rate to fall. So banks can lend money at lower rates. The T-bill, which is the pegging rate for a lot of loans, has gone down, so the economy will begin to improve. That is an open market operation that adds liquidity to the economy. They have been doing that like gangbusters since 2008. Ultimately, the great fear in this has been that too much money for the real growth rate of the economy is going to cause inflation. And I was calling for inflation, but then I began to realize, no. First of all, there was a giant pit left by the 2008 crisis. It was like a giant crater. You can't fill that very easily with new liquidity. But there was another part to it, too, that was going on. The banks were not lending this money out. They were keeping it, and they were investing it in places like the stock market. Hence why, with all of that money that was being thrown into the stock market, instead of being thrown downward into the economy, you had stock prices going up in a way that almost is historically unheard of. This era of these rapidly rising stock prices, that was actually what we call a sector inflation. The rest of the economy was beginning to get by. It struggled, and finally it got on its feet. But that huge appreciation of stock prices, that was fueled by the domestic trading desk moving money to the banks, and the banks were putting it here in the federal funds market, but only long enough to be able to invest it in the stock market. There was another nasty trick that was going on, too. You see, you just gave me money. Okay? So, the price of T-bills was going up, right? Okay, now, what I'll do is wait for the Treasury to do another auction. The government is borrowing money hand over fist. So when the Treasury does an auction, that means that the supply of T-bills goes up. When the supply of T-bills goes up, what happens to their price? Supply of T-bills goes up at every Treasury auction. The price goes where? Down. The price of those goes down, so you know what the banks do? They go to the auction, buy more T-bills, and then the Fed buys those T-bills when the price goes back up, as the Fed bids those prices back up. So then I've got more money, and so what I'll do is wait for another Treasury auction, because the Treasury auction, the supply of government debt goes up, causing the prices to go down. I buy some more T-bills, put them into my portfolio, and then wait for you to call me and buy them at inflated prices. So the money never got down into the bottom of the economy. There you go. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.